Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in today's show, getting young farmers and ranchers involved in advocacy. We talked to someone on the front lines. But first, we reported last week about the push by some members on the LA City Council to ban activities related to rodeos. And that definitely got people talking. So today, we're starting a conversation on what rodeo means to communities. Joining me today on the phone is Mandy Lindquist, who is the marketing manager for the California Rodeo Salinas.
All right, Mandy. So I ran a story about the LA City Council that is trying to ban, basically it's wording that would effectively ban rodeos in the city of Los Angeles, which, you know, there's not a whole lot of rodeo action in the city of Los Angeles, but people are saying that this could have a broader effect on rodeos around the state. And I wanted to talk to you about how rodeos, especially there in Salinas, the community response to rodeos and how it's a part of the community. I know that the rodeo there has been successful for many years now. How long has it been running?
Over 110 years.
Okay. And so what kind of response do you still get from the community there?
It's a huge response. We get over 50,000 people annually attending. We have the rodeo for 4 days and a professional bull riding for a day. And people love it. It's like a social gathering. It's a celebration of Western heritage and tradition. And it's a huge source of pride for our community because this rodeo is actually ranked 10th out of over 600 professional rodeos in the United States, and it's the largest in California.
So, how long have you been involved?
14 years I've been working here, and I grew up in Salinas and have attended the event my whole life.
All right. So what kind of growth and changes have you seen over the years as it's continued running?
Oh, there's definitely changes. You know, technology, I think when I first started working here was the first year we had the big instant replay screen, which is huge. It really helps the fan experience, also allows us to give sponsor benefits, and just make it an overall better event to attend. So that's something they didn't have way back when. It's grown in size. We have usually over 600 competitors. So it's a really big event, and it's just been growing and seeing some of those modern-day advances, as all events are, I think.
Mm-hmm. Growing up, you know, around the rodeo and in rodeo, you have seen... you know, a lot of the community involved. I grew up, I'm from the Clovis area, so of course we have a big rodeo also. And then I also have, you know, done a little bit of work just in my ag reporting and others with rodeos and various things. So there's a strong community just within the rodeo itself. What are those relationships like?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have over 1,400 volunteers and people that live and breathe the rodeo. They want to come out every year. They use their vacation time to volunteer. And also how we work our concessions is local nonprofit groups volunteer their time to earn funds by selling pizza, parking cars, different things, you know, working in the grandstands. And so then we're able to donate over $500,000 annually to local nonprofits and other rodeo causes from hosting the annual events or use of our facility and other fundraising activities. We also give out scholarships, so we're encouraging, you know, furthering education. And those youth groups use the money for equipment, uniforms, traveling. And other nonprofits also will sell, like, hamburgers and stuff here and then turn around and use that money to also donate back to the community. So it's a huge impact. And then we have, like I said, I mentioned over 600 contestants usually, and they bring their families and they stay, and the format of our team roping especially, they'll stay the whole time. So they're out going to restaurants and buying fuel, and some of them that aren't camping in their hotels, or at least our fans too, are staying in hotels. So just the 1 week of events that we have generates over $11 million in economic activity for the city.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, and that was the next thing that I was going to ask you, is about the economic impact for the city, and that is significant.
Right, and we also hold other events throughout the year here at this facility, which we run. We have a lease from the city, but we manage the facility. And so that economic impact is even greater, but our local university did a study just on that week, and it was $11 million.
Wow. That's huge.
Yes. It's fun to be a part of that.
I bet that it is. Now, have you ever participated yourself in the rodeo? Do you?
No, not this. I grew up showing horses in 4-H and having market pigs and things like that, but I haven't actually participated here. I just attended and loved it. And then when the opportunity came up for this marketing position, I was so excited to get it. And I've been here for 14 years.
And it sounds like you still enjoy it.
I do. I mean, I love the Western way of life. I believe in preserving it. I believe in the tradition of it. I just think that it's something that needs to be preserved, and I'm proud to be a part of it.
So I want to expand on that, if that's okay, because especially with this story coming out of Los Angeles, you know, the big city, probably not as many people there understand the Western way of life. But what does that mean to you, that way of life?
Well, I think that there is a disconnect, you know, with urban populations growing, and it's harder for rural people, I think, to tell their story and kind of be heard. I mean, not as many people. I went to Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, and that was a long time ago. And when I did, they said that only 2% of the population was directly involved in agriculture. And if you drill that down to rodeo, that would be even less. So I can see where people just don't know, you know, about the intricacies of it, the fact that there are already laws in place regarding rodeo equipment and usage in California, that the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association, which we're sanctioned by, has over 70 rules pertaining to the safety of livestock and contestants. So I could see where people would see some mistruths that these animal rights activists are talking about and just believe it. But our hope is that they would take the time to ask rodeo experts or people involved in the way of life. And like you said, it's not just rodeo. It's ranching. It's all these things that people don't understand because they're not a part of it. And we would hope that they would reach out to learn. And especially, you know, what disappointed us most about the ordinance proposed by the Los Angeles City Council is that it was done without any input from any real rodeo experts. They just took somebody's complaint or allegation or opinion and ran with it. And, you know, that could, these mistruths that are perpetuated by the animal rights activists could ultimately hurt all segments of agriculture and ranching. And these broad bans, like you're saying, that could impact other areas and potentially end disciplines in the Western industry, it's not the right way to go. And it is difficult to teach that growing urban population about agriculture, but it's something that really needs to be done. Because without agriculture, I mean, nobody's eating, and then it trickles down into all these other things, you know, people that raise cattle and any kind of livestock, really. So it's just disheartening that people don't seek out the other side of the story, if you will.
I almost don't know where to go with that, because you nailed it. I mean, there wasn't another side. The experts were not brought in Los Angeles, the people who actually know about caring for animals and the people who actually know about the animals used in rodeo were never brought into this discussion. So is there something that, you know, for our listeners who, and our listeners are, you know, a broad agricultural audience, they are ranchers and they're involved in the Western lifestyle, but what would you tell them? As we're faced with, you know, more and more regulations proposed like this, what would you tell the listeners of a way that they could get involved?
Well, I mean, something we always encourage anyone who has a concern to reach out to us so that we can tell them the truth about rodeo or if it's your farm or your ranch or whatever, and give them a behind-the-scenes tour. We admit that we need to do a better job at this. I think that we didn't really think it would become as important as it is, but when you drill down to the low number of people that actually know about agriculture and all of the other things that come along with that, it is important to do that. And I think you can use social media to tell your story and try to reach a broader audience. You know, let people know there's nothing to hide and welcome the opportunity to address concerns. And then the other thing would be to get involved, reach out, express your opinion, you know, try to have the relationships with local politicians, but also, you know, now we need everybody to contact the LA City Council and give them their opinion and their knowledge to try to slow this thing, because right now it's just a request for the city attorney to prepare and present an ordinance. The ordinance hasn't actually passed, but you know that ordinance is talking about flank straps and spurs and electric prods, and there's already things in place that regulate those items. So it's just telling them that, hey, we're already, you know, being safe, we're already taking care of the animals, this is what we do. And I don't, another thing, and this might be a little bit of a tangent, but I feel like with the livestock, people don't understand that those animals are worth so much money and they're well taken care of. It would not behoove anyone to be harming those animals in any way. So, you know, the flank stripes are lined with fleece, and there are rules that the electric prods only used for the safety of the contestant or animal in a specific situation, and the spurs are not sharp. So I just think getting out there and telling the story, whether you're a cattle rancher, whether you are a person who loves or competes in rodeo, or a farmer, it's something that everybody has to be working towards, is getting the word out.
All right, and I like that you brought that up too, that the animals are expensive and they are cared for, because, you know, you can't have rodeo without them. So
absolutely.
And you can't just go out and buy another one.
No, exactly. And these, you know, in this instance, through the pandemic and everything, stock contractors haven't been able to take their animals to rodeos and earn money, but yet they're still feeding them and they don't get unemployment checks. And so, I mean, they love their animals, and they are well cared for. They eat before they do. And I just think that people don't really understand that. You know, it's no longer the day where you have a cow in your backyard that you milk. People just go to the grocery store and get what they need and don't really think about what goes into that, the husbandry and all of it. So, I just think it's telling our story is our number one thing, but then actually getting involved and not just sitting there thinking, oh, somebody else will speak up for us. We have to then, like I said, reach out to LA City Council. And then before it gets to your city or your town, make sure that you, if you have the opportunity to establish a relationship with the people that make the decisions, so they're not, it's not so one-sided if something comes up.
Right. Do you have any last thoughts, or was there anything else that we should bring up in this conversation?
Well, I think that something, you know, there's going to be a number of businesses down in Los Angeles. Like you said, there's not necessarily a lot of rodeo activity, but there is a professional bull riding held at the Staples Center that would be impacted. There are charro events. There are things like the Rose Bowl parade. Like, some of these rules could trickle down to hunter jumping, all kinds of different aspects of Western lifestyle. So don't just put your blinders on because it's not impacting you at the moment, or be open-minded to the fact that it could be impacting you and you don't even think that it will. But, you know, so in addition to that, there's going to be an economic impact from not having these events in Los Angeles. And I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of restaurant and business owners that gain impact, you know, economic impact from those events that will see their bottom line negatively affected, all because no one on the LA City Council thought it might be a good idea to have the opinion of real rodeo experts. So definitely keep an open mind. Make sure that, you know, as an ag industry, we're all trying to help and support each other.
Tell me, so for the rodeo in Salinas, when does that come up? And are you, do you get to have one this year, or are we looking at next year?
Right. So typically we're the third week in July. Last year, unfortunately, we had to cancel, like I think every other event in California and maybe across the U.S. But, no, this year we have postponed to September 23rd through the 26th, and we're hopeful that with dropping COVID numbers that there'll be some loosening of regulations, so we're able to host the event and have a crowd here and kind of get back into that community spirit and celebrating the Western lifestyle.
Perfect. Yeah, because that's not really one that you can have virtually.
No. So I will tell you, we will be televised on RFD TV and the Cowboy Channel through the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association. When we moved our dates, it actually puts us on the last weekend of the rodeo, or the last week of the rodeo season for 2021. And so we'll be what they call a Pro Rodeo Tour finale, where we will have the top 24 contestants on the tour in each event here. So that brings down our contestant numbers from, like I said, over 600 down to like 250, because we were anticipating the possibility of having to have limited capacity. So like a lot of events, we're pivoting and trying to be flexible to make sure that we can have something versus nothing. But we are excited about that, because we'll be some of the top contestants. It will be televised. But we also want to be here for our community and be able to have everyone gather and participate. So our fingers are crossed that we're moving in the right direction, and hopefully we'll start seeing some more quote-unquote normalcy soon.
Right.
As I think everyone hopes for.
Yes, I think so too. All right. Well, good luck, and I hope I hope everything goes very smoothly for you for the rest of this planning season. So,
Again,
thank you for your time. I appreciate it. It's an important discussion, I think.
Yes, absolutely, and I appreciate you reaching out.
Thank you once again to Mandy Lindquist with the California Rodeo Salinas. Still to come, we are talking about the young farmers and ranchers of the American Farm Bureau. But up next, today's news brief. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Welcome back. Here's your news brief for today. The House is working on immigration legislation this week. It's set to vote on a pair of immigration bills, one of which is the Farm Workforce Modernization Act. Earlier this month, Representative Zoe Lofgren of California and Dan Newhouse of Washington State reintroduced the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, which they say creates a workforce solution for America's agriculture industry by providing stability, predictability, and fairness to one of the most critical sectors of our nation's economy. The bill would provide a path to legal status for undocumented agricultural workers and expand the H-2A visa program. The USDA Agricultural Marketing Service is seeking comments regarding the development, coordination, and implementation of grant programs to support food processing, distribution, seafood processing, farmers markets, and producers, along with other businesses. These are all businesses identified in the Consolidated Appropriations Act. The legislation directs USDA to use these grant funds to help businesses respond to coronavirus, including for measures to protect workers against COVID-19. Comments can be submitted through midnight Eastern Time on March 31st via an online portal. They say they welcome feedback from all interested parties and appreciate an early response. Additional information is available on the AMS website. In addition, AMS will host a listening session to provide groups and individuals an opportunity to share their views on how USDA can best serve the industry through this program. All interested stakeholders are invited to attend. Stakeholders are also invited to register to provide oral comments during the session. The listening session will be conducted via a webinar using Zoom. The Chinese market for American ag products is expected to continue growing. Stephanie Ho looks at some commodities that have already benefited in this edition of Agriculture USA.
Daniel Whitley is acting administrator of USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service. He is bullish on the China market.
The USDA came out with its latest quarterly forecast for 2021 agricultural exports. And if you hadn't seen the numbers, they are quite fascinating, with exports expected to reach more than $31 billion for China. So if that doesn't excite you and whet your appetite for this session, I don't know what does.
He was moderating a panel focusing on China at USDA's annual Agricultural Outlook Forum. One of the speakers was David Dollar, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, who pointed to what he called a persistent upward trend in China's agricultural imports.
And even though the virus virus provided a little bit of disruption at the beginning of 2020, it's actually quite striking how steady the growth of their agricultural imports are.
I'm Stephanie Ho, and in this week's Agriculture USA, we'll look at just how important China is as a market for U.S. agricultural products. The importance of China as a market for U.S. agricultural exports was underscored by Biden administration Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
I think we've seen in some commodities record purchases by the Chinese, and most recently, very large purchases of commodities. And I think that's one of the reasons why, if you look at commodity prices today versus where they were a year ago, you're going to see across the board increases, which obviously is good news. And for many farmers, ranchers, and producers, it's the best news they've had in some time.
At USDA's Agricultural Outlook Forum, trade counselor Jason Halfmeister pointed to U.S. agriculture's share of total Chinese imports before and after the trade war, which dates back to 2017.
About 20-25% of China's imports came from the United States of ag products. Trade war cut that down around 10. Last year, we bounced back to 14.
In his presentation, he showed a chart that forecasts steep increases in Chinese purchases of U.S. soybeans.
This is a most stunning graph you'll see all day. This is Chinese imports of soybeans. You know, from 2010 to 2030, they've gone from 45 million metric tons to maybe 140. You know, what a game changer that has been.
Another bright spot in ag trade has been U.S. corn sales to China, which started off the year slowly.
But contracts were signed and boats loaded at the end of the year and turned into a record year for us on corn to China.
Looking at another row crop, sorghum.
China is a huge market for us in sorghum. It takes 90% or so of our crop when things are going right. And so to have China back in the market, it was of incredible value to us.
He says China's demand for U.S. wheat also surpassed pre-trade war numbers. Meanwhile, it was a great year for cotton.
Even with the pandemic, China was restocking. When they are restocking, their state buyers have always shown a preference for high-quality U.S. cotton. And so this was a year they were in the market, and thankfully we were able to participate in that. Seafood, not such a good story. This is a phase one product. Tariffs were removed, but maybe pandemic-related, other restrictions.
Another development that will have huge implications for this country is China's strong demand for protein.
This importing meat in China has kind of taken us by surprise.
Fred Gale is with USDA's Economic Research Service.
Back in 2010, we projected that China would be importing roughly 1 million tons of meat by now. And then 5 years later, we ratcheted that up to about 2 to 3 million tons by now. But they actually imported over 9 million tons last year, and that was partly due to the disease outbreak.
The disease he's referring to is African swine fever, which hit China's pig herds.
Our projections show that China will continue to grow those meat imports up to more than 10 million tons by the end of the projection period. So this is something that's caught us all off guard. The Chinese projections don't take this into account either. They're even more conservative.
He says ERS's Agricultural Projections to 2030 report shows China will be the world's top importer of beef and pork and a significant importer of poultry. In 2030, China and Hong Kong are projected to account for nearly half of the world's imports of pork.
6 million tons versus 7 million tons for other countries. We have them importing 4.3 million tons of beef versus 7.8 for other countries. That's remarkable considering that China's imports of beef just surpassed 1 million tons about 3 years ago.
Meanwhile, ERS projects that by 2030, China will be importing 1.7 million tons of poultry, which he says is a change from previous projections that China would be a net poultry exporter. So as USDA Trade Counsel Jason Halfmeister says, the overall prospects are positive.
China is our number one market. The trade war knocked it down, but we're back on trend, and we see a lot of potential in a free trade environment to significantly expand our sales there.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's your news for today. When we come back, we're talking about meeting your crop's nitrogen needs. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Welcome back. Our Taylor Chalstrom sat down recently with Aaron Wingate, an agronomist with Tritech Ag Products, Inc., to discuss tightening the nitrogen cycle in organic agriculture and how to meet crop nitrogen needs without impacting the environment. Here are highlights from that conversation.
Aaron, in your recent article for Organic Farmer, you state that the most efficient, environmentally friendly fields have, quote, tight nitrogen cycles. Can you explain that further?
Sure. A field with a tight nitrogen cycle is one where you don't have a lot of nitrogen in the soil solution, meaning if you test the soil for nitrate, you're not going to get a very high number and you're not in danger of leaching very much nitrate. But when you look at the crop, it has plenty of nitrogen in the leaf tissue, it's growing well, and it's in these optimum levels. So these are all indicators that the microbes in the soil are doing a very good job at taking the inputs, the organic amendments, and converting them at a steady rate into plant-available nitrogen form. The opposite of a field with a tight nitrogen cycle would be one with a lot of spikes and crashes. So when you apply an amendment, you might first get net immobilization, meaning that the microbes consume a lot of that nitrogen and don't release any back to the plant. And then later on, their population might crash and release all of the nitrogen at once. So that's one where you might have times where the plant is stressed and not getting enough. And then when there's too much and there's potential for leaching, we want a really steady nitrogen supply where there's always just enough.
Okay. And, you know, in those organic situations, when those microbes convert organic nitrogen to nitrate, can you just explain a little bit what the sheer effects of that nitrogen leaching really is on the environment?
Oh, wow. Nitrogen leaching impacts the environment in several different ways. It can cause eutrophication on a larger scale. It leaches down through the soil and can pollute groundwater. So that is dangerous, especially for children, for babies. And you don't want to be drinking water with nitrate in it. When it runs off and enters rivers and streams, it can disrupt the ecological systems, causing algal blooms. And in those worst situations, causing the eutrophication and dead zones, like in the Gulf of Mexico. So it's very, very important not to allow our nitrate to leach. And from a farmer's perspective, you don't want to be throwing away fertilizer that you've bought and invested in. So it's best for everyone to try to be as efficient as possible.
Definitely. Thanks, Aaron. Yeah. And those organic amendments, like you talk about in your article, are an important tool for organic growers to meet crop nitrogen needs without impacting the environment, causing that leaching. How do those organic amendments work and how are they best applied?
Organic amendments are any fertilizers that come from a source that was alive. So it could be the byproducts of life, manure. It can also be products that come from fisheries or from animal production. So there are feather and blood meal products, and there are liquid organic fertilizers that come from decomposing food scraps. And then there's really simple things like green waste compost. All of those are carbon-based amendments. And carbon-based because all life is carbon-based. And it comes along with the nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and micronutrients. But because it's in this organic matter form. It needs to first be broken down by microbes in the soil before it can be available for the plants to take it up.
That's an important point because in conventional agriculture, like you mentioned in your article, they have access to those fertilizers, which offer that immediate nitrogen uptake to the crop. But for organic, like you just mentioned, it's really not that simple. You gotta wait a little bit.
Yeah, it's not as straightforward. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to write the article was because we have such a wide range of organic amendments to choose from. And we want to choose the ones that are going to be the most useful at different times in crop production.
Definitely. And in your article, you cite research from UC Davis that identified what you just talked about, those four main amendment categories based on their nitrogen mineralization potential. Can you explain those categories a little more and how each of those functions differently in the soil when used?
Sure. Okay, so there are four categories, like you said, and I just want to say thank you for the researchers at UC Davis. And this study was published in 2020 by Patricia Lazicki, and she did this cool experiment where she and all of her collaborators did a soil incubation where they put soil into jars and added these different amendments and monitored those jars to see how much of the nitrogen in the amendment was mineralized, meaning converted from organic form into ammonium over 84 days. And so I really like the way that they categorize the organic amendments. And the first one is plant-based compost. So it's pretty self-explanatory. It's just anything that's made from plants, and it's composted. So the carbon to nitrogen ratio on that is between 13 and 20, which is fairly high. It's got a small amount of nitrogen to the amount of carbon. And when they applied this to soil, at first they got net immobilization. So the microbes were feeding on that carbon and taking up the nitrogen and incorporating it into their bodies. And they didn't have any excess nitrogen to give to the plant for quite a long time. So after 84 days, less than 5% of the nitrogen in those plant-based composts had mineralized. So that implies that this isn't the kind of amendment that you're going to use if you need to supply your crop with nitrogen very quickly. The next category was still pretty slow to convert to ammonium, but it was faster than the plant-based, and this is manure-based compost. It had a slightly lower carbon to nitrogen ratio, and after 84 days, up to 30% of the nitrogen in the manure was converted to plant-available form. The third category is a better supply of nitrogen for a crop. And this category is granular organic fertilizers. So those are anything that you can buy that's a dry organic fertilizer. It could be blood or feather meal or a pelleted product. The carbon to nitrogen ratio there ranged from 1 to 7, which is quite low. And after 84 days, depending on the product, between 35 and 55% of it mineralized. So that's a pretty good source. If you want a slow releasing nitrogen for your crop, you can apply that pre-plant and be pretty safe. The fourth category is very interesting. This is very similar to the nitrogen release that growers can get in conventional. This is the organic liquids. They include like fish emulsions, products made from food scraps that have been digested and turned into a liquid with an analysis of like 3-2-2, for instance. And these liquid-based organic fertilizers have a C-to-N ratio between 3 and 5. And after 84 days, up to 90% of the nitrogen mineralized. That's really high. Not only that, but after 2 weeks, most of that mineralization had already occurred. So this is the fertilizer you want to use if you need to supply your crop with nitrogen now, within the week, within 2 weeks. But the other side of that is that you don't want to use too much at once, and you don't want to use it too early in the season, because as soon as the nitrogen mineralizes, it will be prone to leaching, just like any other conventional fertilizer would. So this is a powerful tool, but one to be careful with.
Is there a difference in the leaching, the overall leaching potential between any of those? I know they all kind of mineralize at different times, but do they also leach the same, or is it different?
That's a very good question. Although all of these materials start out in an organic form with differing properties, once they're converted to nitrate, all nitrate acts the same. So whether your nitrate is coming from, conventional can 17, or whether it's been recently mineralized from an organic fertilizer, or whether it's nitrate from the water, it all has the same leaching potential. That said, the organic form of fertilizer itself, that is something I don't know, and that's a good question. Maybe applying organic matter along with the nitrogen source and building up your microbial biomass will prevent some of that nitrogen leaching. So that's another aspect of this tight nitrogen cycling, where if you can get a robust microbial community, those microbes are acting like the bank, and the nitrate is like the cash. So you don't want to have too much cash in your pocket at any given time. You want it to just be releasing a little bit. And so if you are using like one of the green waste composts and you're adding in a lot of carbon to that system, you may lower your overall nitrogen leaching potential because you're cultivating a big microbial community that can store a lot of nutrients.
Again, that was Taylor Chaustrom talking with Aaron Wingate. To hear the whole interview, visit myaglife.com and click on podcast. When we come back, we're talking about young farmers and ranchers and their involvement in the future of agriculture. We'll be right back.
Having problems with nematodes? ProMax is your number one solution. ProMax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. ProMax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRight Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/ProMax for more information.
Welcome back. The American Farm Bureau had its Fusion Reimagined conference over the weekend. On Friday, I talked with Jocelyn Anderson from Willows, California, where her family has an almond and walnut farm. She is the vice chair of the California Young Farmers and Ranchers and is also on the American Farm Bureau Young Farmers and Ranchers National Committee, serving her second year as vice chair. Here's our conversation.
So how did you get involved in the Young Farmers and Ranchers?
Yeah, so my dad's actually been a Farm Bureau member and a director for years and years. And so I grew up, in 4-H and knowing what Farm Bureau was because my dad was always involved. So when I came back to the family farm about 4 years ago, I jumped right into getting involved with Young Farmers and Ranchers locally in my county. And then from there, got more involved in the state and then on a national level.
Okay, now you're very involved, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah, I am. I just kind of really enjoy it. I love being able to be an advocate for farming in general, as well as my family farm, and really being able to have a say in the future of agriculture. It's just so important that we have strong voices, especially, from younger farmers and ranchers who are just maybe starting out on their family farm, or maybe you have been working there for a while, but really are that next generation of ag. And, you know, we need as many people, younger people involved as we can get.
So when you first became a Farm Bureau member, how did you go from being just a Farm Bureau member to becoming so active in the young farmers and ranchers?
Yeah, so, you know, most counties have programs throughout the state of California, and you can contact your local Farm Bureau office to get involved and get in touch with whoever is, you know, the president or the chair, the vice chair of your local YF&R group. And from there, we're in constant communication as a state committee where we represent regions in California. So, for example, on the state committee, I represent Glynn County, Yolo County, and Colusa County, and it's kind of set up like that throughout the entire state. So you have one direct person who your local county can get information from about what's going on a statewide level. And then every 2 years, the district seats become available for someone to be appointed. They apply and can be appointed to that position. So, you know, once you get involved with your local level and your county and you spend some time getting involved there, you have a lot of options going forward to become more involved on the state or even a national level.
So when you were growing up, obviously growing up on a farm, did you know that agriculture was something you always wanted to stay in?
It's funny because I actually I went to college at Cal Poly and I actually got my teaching credential and I taught kindergarten and first grade originally as my first job. And later in life realized that I really enjoyed the ag side of my family farming history and wanted to get back into that. So I decided to come back to the family farm, and it's the best decision I've ever made.
So what do you do on the farm now?
So I help my dad with just management of our family farm. So anything, you know, from working daily, running equipment to managing other aspects of the farm, just depending on what my dad needs help with. You know, like right now we're in frost season, so we have to monitor frost in the middle of the night, make sure we have to go turn on pumps, you know, if it gets too cold for the almonds and the walnuts. And then we also have a walnut huller. And so when we're in walnut harvest from about mid-September to the beginning of November, we're working every day, all day, running the walnut huller.
What would you say are some of the top priorities or top issues for somebody like you who is involved in the young farms and ranchers? What are some of the things that you are most concerned about right now?
Yeah, you know, I think there's always been a lot of talk about labor. It doesn't necessarily affect me personally where I'm at on our family farm, but in general there's a lot of people who manage or work with companies who have really large labor forces, and it's not always easy coming by people to work on your farm, and working with H2A programs can be pretty expensive and have a lot going on to work with. That's a big one. Obviously water has been a big topic of concern going forward as well. So there's a couple things that definitely, depending on where you are, that may affect you more than other places. But those I would say are some of the top two things. And then I always like to focus on like food safety and stuff too. Sometimes we're getting some pretty big regulations, you know, that have come out in the last few years, and just making sure facilities are up to code and meet all the requirements that CDFA and USDA put out.
So the Fusion Conference is happening, and it is virtual this year, which is a change from previous years, but it's because of the pandemic, of course. What kind of things do you get out of conferences like this, and why do you attend?
Yeah, so, I'm on the national committee, so I am hosting a few sessions and have helped, you know, put some of this together. But unfortunately, since we can't meet in person because of, you know, the lingering COVID concerns, it's a great way to still feel like you're attending a conference and, you know, really tap into those virtual resources. We have tons of breakout sessions available for people to listen to. The YF&R Collegiate Discussion Meet is going on right now, and people can tune in to all the sessions. The Sweet 16 is happening tonight at 5:30 EST. There's engagement power hours we're doing today and tomorrow. There's ag tours that are on demand that you can look at and learn about all different types of agriculture across the U.S. It's great because we set up the platform to be able to have attendees interact with each other in a virtual setting. So there's like chat rooms and everything like that. There's member engagement resources. There's an auction going on, which is all the money is donated to our foundation. And there's even like a kids corner, because a lot of YFNRs our age have children and built in a little space where the kids can do something and have a fun corner they can go to. And then there's a fun scavenger hunt where there's like a leaderboard and you can get points for watching sessions and answering questions, and podcast resources where there's a few podcasts that people have done and that are up on the site. So there's a lot going on. And then there's obviously the live like general sessions as well that, you know, happen throughout the day. So it's a great resource. You can find a lot of information on there, and, you know, it's a fun thing to do because we can't get together in person. At least we can do it over Zoom and virtually.
Right. Okay, so this is normally a very rude question to ask somebody, so please forgive me, but how old are you?
Oh, yeah, no worries. I'm 33. And so okay. Young farmers and ranchers, typically the age bracket is 18 to 35. So anyone who's in the age range of 18 to 35 can join Young Farmers and Ranchers and get involved.
So that is a pretty wide group, and there's a lot of differences between an 18-year-old and somebody who's 34 or 35. So do you, in these encounters at the meetings and things, do you get a wide range of, you know, references, a wide range of experiences?
We definitely do. And I would say typically, you know, we look at Young Farmers and Ranchers as like the next step after FFA. So if you were highly involved in FFA in high school and say you go to college, and typically a lot of colleges have collegiate farm bureaus. And so they have kind of a group, you know, at college where they sometimes, you know, have even colleges that have discussion meet, like teams who work on discussion meet stuff. And then you can do collegiate farm bureau. And then once you graduate college, you can also go back and join, you know, wherever you go for a job, you can join the Young Farmers and Ranchers group there. Definitely see a wide range because a lot of people, you know, go straight from FFA right into Young Farmers and Ranchers for whatever they do after high school. But it's nice because, you know, especially with our breakout sessions and stuff, I feel like there's always something to learn. And there's so many different options that, you know, whether, you know, you're a little bit younger on the younger side of the age bracket or on the higher and older side of the age bracket, there's always something you can learn from. And I just feel like you can never really stop learning. So it's such a great resource to be able to do this, you know, virtually this year, especially because some people wouldn't be able to attend in person anyways. And so it's a great option to have.
And then when there's not a conference going on, what kind of things do you do in the Young Farmers and Ranchers?
Yeah, so typically on our national committee, I actually run the social media for the AFBF YFNR group on the national committee. I used to run it for California too, but we switched positions. And so now the current secretary is running it. So I spend a lot of time kind of planning out social media posts and doing things like that. And then in general, we're, you know, planning. We spend a lot of time in advanced planning conferences. We do a lot of, you know, work to give back to the community. We're always doing a Harvest for All. It's called Harvest for All, and we're always collecting, you know, food for food banks and things like that. It's a little, like, competition because you can enter at the end of the year how much your state was able to donate in time and actually material food and things like that. We typically in California have a summer leaders meeting as well as a conference for our YFNRs. And so we spend a lot of time working on that stuff. It keeps us busy. That's for sure.
So for farmers, or for people who are listening to this and in that age group, what would you tell them as far as getting involved in advocacy for agriculture?
Yeah, it's so important. I had my first advocacy experience when I was in the Leadership Farm Bureau group in 2019. So California Farm Bureau offers a program called Leadership Farm Bureau. It's a full-year program. They accept 10 people per year who are Farm Bureau members and apply. And it's a great program, and that's really where I got my first steps into being involved in advocacy. And, you know, it's so important. I know we can't, you know, it's been COVID for the past year, but when it wasn't, and when we go back to somewhat of a normal life and we can travel again, it's so important to travel to Washington, D.C. and be able to kind of tell your story to legislators. You know, for example, when we went, we were talking about getting walnuts into into the payback deal, you know, because they lost so much money back in 2018, 2019-ish. And we kind of broke it down when talking to one of the head staffers for actually Nancy Pelosi's office we got a meeting with. And, you know, we had to put it in kind of more simple terms. And, you know, we let her know that it was walnut farmers that year basically lost half of their paycheck because the price, you know, went down so much. And that's the reason we wanted to get it in into the program. And, you know, they were shocked. They couldn't believe that. So just really being able to share your story, sharing how it affects your family farm or even, you know, other farms around you is so important because legislators aren't always farmers and they don't always have a background of knowledge in farming. And, you know, just being there as a farmer who usually works on my farm every day and being able to go to D.C. and talk to staffers and legislators is so important for the future of agriculture in general.
Thank you again to Jocelyn Anderson. That is our show for today. If you know of a topic or a person we should feature, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.